again, and welcome to Musings on Sports, where great storytelling is our passion. I'm Kelly Elbin, along with Bob Bupka. And Bob, as the old saying goes, the United States of America did what it had to do today to advance to the knockout round of the 2022 World Cup. Christian Pulisic, Captain America, the very face of soccer in the United States, scored off a terrific header and in the first half, then collided with the goalie, and his ability to play in the game against the Netherlands on Saturday is going to be in question because of an abdominal injury. But for now, great excitement with a 1-0 victory over the Iranians, and on they go. And Bob, only in soccer, by the way, can you score a grand total of 2 goals in 3 games and yet advance out of group play to the round of 16.
Yeah, it's different. You know, soccer, I've grown a bigger fan just watching the World Cup this year. I mean, there's so much excitement within the excitement, not in the goal scoring. Of course, that's the culmination of some good play. But fortunately for me, Janice's son, Brad Self, worked for Nike and worked with the soccer team for a long time. So I've picked his brain over the years, and I've gotten to know more and more about the sport. It's fascinating. It's exhilarating. Certainly, it's good for you physically. And quite frankly, I was very excited with that 1-0 win over Iran.
Yeah, and the athleticism is just off the charts for all of these teams. This is the third consecutive time that the U.S. has been in the World Cup that it has advanced to the round of 16. I don't know anything about the Netherlands, but I anticipate another stout defensive effort on Saturday morning when they get together our time in the States and see if they can advance. Maybe another 1-0 victory will be in order. Hey, Bob, really excited. You and I talked to Harvey Green, longtime PR executive with the Yankees and the Dolphins. We talked to Harvey last week, and our listeners are going to hear from him later. Just some classic George Steinbrenner, Don Shula, Jimmy Johnson stories that I think people are going to get a real kick out of.
Yeah, don't forget Billy Martin. Stories.
Yes, forgot about Billy.
With Billy Martin were very fascinating. I mean, we're fortunate to have gotten inside track on somebody like Harvey Green and, you know, worked with all those names that you said over the years. And I know our listeners on Musings are going to enjoy that one with Harvey Green.
Well, football was a huge part of his life, almost 30 years with the Miami Dolphins organization. A lot of football to talk about, but we have to discuss the implications of Tiger Woods' withdrawal at the Hero World Challenge in the Bahamas. You know, short term, is he going to be able to play in the match and in the father-son with his son Charlie? Sounds like it, because he even said that he can play and ride around in carts as opposed to walking. The plantar fasciitis is an issue. But instead of me talking a lot, let's hear what Tiger has to say about it.
I can hit golf balls. It's the walking that just hurts. So that's just something that when you got plantar fasciitis, the only thing you can do is rest and try and stretch that out as best as possible. But it's rest. I mean, how do you rest when you're hosting a tournament? You know, it's hard. So this will be a tough week. The father-son will be a very easy week. Charlie will just hit out all the shots, and I'll just get the putts out of the hole. So pretty easy there. But other than that, you know, in the match we're playing, we're flying in carts, 12 holes. So.
Well, anybody that's preparing to watch the father-son, don't be prepared to see little Charlie play, because he's no longer little. He's really grown up, and God, he's a spitting image of his dad. It's just fascinating, because I knew Earl Woods, which was Tiger's dad, and when Tiger was a, you know, pretty much a youngster, and to see him develop, and now to see you know, Charlie Woods following his dad's footsteps, just incredible.
Yeah, no better mentor for Charlie to have than his dad, both from physical preparation as well as the mental side. Okay, so it looks like the match is in play. It looks like the time with Charlie, the father-son, is in play. But Bob, how much will we see Tiger long-term? How much does he have left? Let's see what he has to say.
The goal is to play just the major championships and maybe one or two more. That's it. I mean, that's physically, that's all I can do. I mean, I don't have much left in this leg. So gear up for the biggest ones, and hopefully, you know, lightning catches in a bottle. And I'm up there in contention with a chance to win, and hopefully I'll remember how to do that. You know, giving myself a chance to get out there again. I didn't expect to play three majors this year. We were hoping for just the British Open, but I was able to get two more in there. So that was a big positive.
You know, one thing about Tiger and him saying, admitting the positive outlook would be for him to play one or two tournaments and the four majors. The problem for Tiger, and I'm sure he's aware of it, even though he didn't allude to it, you know, the majors come April, May, June, July. It's not like they're spaced out and he can recover from playing in one. So I think it would be marvelous for golf fans if we got to see Tiger in five events a year, four majors, and maybe his event at Riviera, the Genesis. We're beginning to see the end of Tiger. You know, so many young, talented guys coming on board, and it gets harder and harder. But like he admitted, he can still hit golf shots, but there's much more to golf than just hitting golf shots. I mean, it's a physically demanding sport, and Tiger's operations and accidents and everything that he's had to endure are beginning to take its toll.
Well, let's not forget, he's going to be 47 years old on December 30th, and that's, by golf standards, an old 47-year-old body. He's put himself through a lot, and I know he'd love to be able to play in the Genesis event out at Riviera in Los Angeles, another event with his that helps his foundation, and as he mentioned, the four majors. But let's just hope he's able to get around the golf course. I was struck as well, Bob. He has been very open in regards to his comments about LIV Golf, and he added to the chorus that Rory McIlroy started when Rory mentioned that, in his opinion, he felt like Greg Norman had to go when it comes to any kind of relationship developing, coming to the table in some peaceful way between LIV Golf and the PGA Tour. And Tiger added to that today. Were you surprised at all to hear that?
I was surprised to hear that because, to some extent, he's voicing the opinion or he's telling the, you know, Saudi Arabians that this is what they should do. They should get rid of Greg Norman. I mean, Greg Norman, whether you like LIV or you don't like LIV, he's brought LIV a long way to where it initially started. Most experts said, well, it'll never get its foot on the ground. Well, it's gotten its foot on the ground, and now the next crossroads for LIV certainly is going to be the reaction of the majors, and that's going to be dictated initially by Fred Ridley, who runs the Masters. If Fred makes the decision that LIV players can participate if they are eligible, that's a whole new ball of wax.
While we're on that, and granted we're late November, several months out still from the Masters, what's your thought as we talk now in terms of, would Fred Ridley dare tell some of the LIV players you can't play? Would he, in essence, dilute his major championship for purposes, you know, beyond just maybe the playing of the game, the political side? Would he do that?
You know, that's a great question. You know, I think first and foremost, Fred Ridley has to put the Masters above any decision that he makes. And to rule that the previous champions are not going to be eligible, it's certainly going to dilute the Masters. To how much degree? Nobody really knows that answer. But I think ultimately, and I could be wrong on this, I think Fred Ridley is going to say, you know, if you're eligible to play in the Masters, we want to see you.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think that's exactly what will happen. They may change some other criteria, but they're not going to hurt their own event, which is the arguably the single, you know, most anticipated and desired major to win of them all. Let's breeze through some football stuff here real quick. We've got Harvey Green coming up later. Harvey, again, longtime PR with the Yankees, as was fired a few times by Mr. Steinbrenner. That's surprising. And then almost 30 years with Coach Shula and Coach Jimmy Johnson with the Dolphins. Speaking of coaches, I think Deion Sanders is ready, and the offer apparently, not apparently, the offer has been made by the University of Colorado to bring Deion in as their coach. He's proven at the historically black college level that he can coach. 11-0 this season with Jackson State. They're playing the SWAC championship on Saturday against Southern. I think they'll win that game. Colorado has fallen on hard times. 1-11 this year. They were not competitive at all in their lost final game against Utah. I think Deion makes a lot of sense and brings some much needed life to that program. Staying out west, Caleb Williams, Bob. I don't know if you saw this, but the Heisman race has been a bit muddled this year. You've had the likes of C.J. Stroud at Ohio State, who really didn't play well in the last few games, and particularly against Michigan, they just got their rear ends kicked by the Wolverines. And then Hendon Hooker, the terrific quarterback out of Tennessee, got hurt. And then Caleb Williams at USC. Just played an incredible football game against Notre Dame. I mean, moving around, making big plays and to win that game. And I anticipate that he's going to lead the Trojans to a victory in the Pac-12 championship game over Utah, which beat USC earlier this year. And I think he's primed, if you will, for the Heisman Trophy. A final thing in college, you know, money speaks, Bob. And Lane Kiffin, who I suppose he was tempted by possibility of leaving Ole Miss and going to Auburn, but increasing your salary for some reason, Bob, from $7.5 to $9 million makes you want to stay. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I'm not sure why he would have done that anyway. It's also been interesting to me to see Matt Rhule, who, you know, dabbled in the NFL for a few years with Carolina after doing terrific jobs at Temple and at Baylor. He's got a big resurrection project at Nebraska where he's signed on to be their head coach. So a lot going on in the college game right now.
Yeah, Matt's going to a good institution. I mean, Nebraska once regarded the premier collegiate football team in the country. Yeah. They got the funds. They got the recruiting power. I look for Matt Rhule to do a good job there at Nebraska.
I do too, and I would be stunned if he ever goes back to the NFL again. I think once these guys, he's a college coach, and good for him to give it a shot. It didn't work out. It got a whole bunch of money walking out the door in Carolina. On to the NFL real quick before we get to Harvey. What a fantastic story in Washington, which has won 6 of 7 games and is now, if the playoffs were to start today, they would be in it. Brian Robinson Jr., their running back out of Alabama. For God's sake, Bob, this young man was shot in the leg in a carjacking a week before the season started. He didn't play in the first few games, lucky to be alive, and then humongous game on Sunday against the Atlanta Falcons. And then Taylor Heineke, whose statistics as a quarterback really don't impress at all, and yet there's intangibles in football, and he makes enough plays, and it's amazing how guys rally around certain players, and they've rallied around him. Washington has 2 big games coming up back-to-back against the New York Giants. They have a bye-in between, but they're looking good. The Minnesota Vikings have the opportunity to be the first NFL team to clinch a playoff spot by winning the NFC North with a victory on Sunday, and then if the Lions were to lose to Jacksonville, that would clinch it for them. So with a lot of drama with Aaron Rodgers and so forth in Green Bay, all Minnesota has done is won a whole bunch. They're 9-2, really great receiver in Justin Jefferson. Interesting also the return of Deshaun Watson this weekend after a whole bunch of off-field shenanigans, sexual misconduct, and of all places, as he comes back with the Cleveland Browns or makes his debut, of all places, he goes to play in Houston, where he played for the Texans for a number of years. That's going to be really interesting to see how he's greeted. Final item for me on the NFL, Bob, and mentioned Harvey Green, the Dolphins with Tua Tagovailoa and some really speedy receivers on the outside, flying high going into a big game Sunday at San Francisco. The 49ers have gone 4 straight weeks with no points allowed in the second half. So while the Eagles are certainly the best team, I believe, right now in the NFC, San Francisco and the Vikings are not far behind.
Yeah, I think San Francisco might be toughest competitor in the league right now. So we'll see how well the the Dolphins do. You're right about how well they have been playing. Yeah. But that's a big game Sunday at San Francisco.
Yeah, it really is. And talk about big games. Harvey Green, longtime PR executive, has been through a lot of them in his terrific career. And we're going to be hearing all about stories of George Steinbrenner and Billy Martin and on from Harvey Green right after this commercial from our good friends at Titleist.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number. And more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game. So you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Sports. Bob, for the past 40 years, our guest today has been a senior communications executive in Major League Sports, heading the public relations department of teams in the NFL, Major League Baseball, and the NBA. Along the way, he has worked with the likes of colossal sports figures, such as George Steinbrenner, coaches Don Shula and Nick Saban, and Jimmy Johnson. And he joins us today to talk all about it. Harvey Green, welcome to Musings on Sports.
Thanks, and thanks for making me feel old. 40 years in the business, but it's been a lot of fun and a great ride.
You're just a puppy at 40 years, believe me.
Yeah, well, after working for those guys, you age very quickly. Yeah,
I know about that. Anyway, thanks for coming and sharing some of your valuable time with us. I know our listeners are going to really enjoy what you have to say. You actually started your career as a PR director for the Madison Square Garden Network. It's only the country's largest regional sports television network. Do you have any particular stories that stand out from those years in the early 80s?
Yeah, that was pretty much the most fun I had at any job in those 40 years that you mentioned. You know, back then, ESPN didn't have all the rights that they do now for all these sports. So if you wanted to watch sports in New York City, you had to watch it on MSG Network, which had everything going on at the Garden, which was obviously a magical place for me at that time. I was a New Yorker, and so here I am getting paid to go to games and sit in the press box for Knicks games, Ranger games, college basketball games, track and field, tennis, boxing. I mean, it was great. You didn't know who would show up outside your office. One day you'd go in, and you'd see John McEnroe or Chris Everett, or you'd run into Joe Frazier, but not very hard because he was a little bigger than I was. Or you'd see Lou Carnesecker, the head coach at St. John's, and Willis Reed. So it was a blast. And every so often you'd get a call to come down to the court to play some pickup basketball. And the next thing you know, you're playing on the Knicks court at Madison Square Garden trying to guard Dave the Busher, who was the Knicks GM at the time. I was a little overmatched, to put it mildly. But, you know, that was the most fun I had basically doing anything. The only thing that came close to that was when I was with the Yankees. The middle game of a three-day road trip was early batting practice. So the guys who were struggling would come out early to the ballpark, and I always wanted people to shag. So I would always go out to the outfield and shag all the fly balls for these guys. Nobody else really wanted to do it except some of the other pitchers running around out there. So I'm out in left field in front of the Green Monster or doing it at Comiskey Park, and realized people would pay like $50,000 to do what I was doing for and getting paid for it. Yeah. But one day I got a little too big for my britches, and I said, you know what, I'm going to go down to third base, see if I could field some grounders. And Dave Winfield was taking BP, and he looked at me and says, you got to be kidding me. So the first pitch came, and he rifled a line drive, and I ducked to get out of the way. Then the second pitch came, and he hit a one-hopper that basically hit me in the chest and almost knocked me out. So I got up, jogged back to the outfield. Winfield was sitting there cracking up, and I said, Winnie, you're right. You win. I will never do that again. So you get some nice perks in this business.
Yeah, see, you should have known you were an outfielder, not an infielder.
But yeah, anyway, I also should have known I wasn't a good defensive player because the Busher kind of lit it up every time I tried to guard him. So I knew I was out of my league there, too.
Hey, Harvey, you were honored for your work with the Cleveland Cavaliers, the New York Yankees, and during your 29 years with the Miami Dolphins, what does a public relations staff have to do well to be successful at the highest levels of sport?
And you guys know this because of your own backgrounds, and this is the one time I'll probably be a little serious. You've got to have a couple of things, but I think the most important are people skills. And even in this day and age of Twitter and social media, I always look at myself as my job with the Yankees was to make friends for the Yankees or to make friends for the Cavaliers. And one year when I was with the Dolphins, they wanted to change my title when I got promoted from Director of Public Relations to Senior VP of Communications. And I said, no, the most important word in that title is relations. And I think that's really what you try to do is to build friends for the organization. But you also need to do that with integrity, because you have to have the trust of the people you're working with and the people you're working for. If your players, head coach, and owner don't trust you, you're not going to be able to get the accurate information to pass on to the media. And if the media doesn't trust you, if you ever lie to them, then they'll never believe a word that you might say. And sometimes when your organization or players or team are put in difficult positions and you're trying to explain things and try to be honest with them, if they don't believe you or trust you, then you're not going to be able to give them in their minds credible information, and you're going to be failing at your job. So to me, you have to have the integrity and understand the relationships part. Everything else you can learn. You can learn how to write. You can understand how the sports works, whether you're moving from basketball to baseball, to football, as I did, or even the different types of personalities. But if you don't know how to get along with people and understand that once you lose your integrity, you'll never get it back, those are the two most important things I would tell anybody looking to get into the communications field, whether it's sports or otherwise.
Yeah, and integrity and people skills, so important in anything that we do in life. And Harvey Green, our guest today on Musings on Sports, public relations executive to the likes of George Steinbrenner, Coach Shula, Coach Saban, Coach Jimmy Johnson, is at the top of the list for those two attributes. Hey, Harvey, okay, 4 years in the 80s, you were the main spokesman for the boss, Mr. Steinbrenner. You had Billy Martin around. You had George. You had Lou Piniella around. I'm just going to ask, give me a couple of great stories having to do with the boss, with Billy, and with Lou.
Let me backtrack for 1 second. I know when we kicked some ideas around for the show, you asked me about my Olympic experience in 1984 in basketball. And I just want to tell you what that was like, because it was kind of an interesting story before I talked to you about Steinbrenner. In 84, I was running the press setup for the basketball tournament at the Olympic Games in L.A., and that was the year the U.S. arguably had its best amateur team ever. Patrick Ewing, Michael Jordan, Chris Mullin, even Charles Barkley didn't make that team. That's how good it was.
Wow.
So my job at the gold medal game was to go into the winning locker room and get some quickie quotes from some of the players and the head coach, because it was drug testing and also the medal ceremony right after that. So I needed to get some quickie quotes. And sure enough, the U.S. team won. It was coached by Bobby Knight. And I understood that Coach Knight knew I was coming into the locker room to get some quick quotes. So I walk in there wearing this lime green L.A. Olympic Committee uniform on. I mean, I stood out like a tree in a forest. And I walk into Coach Knight with pad and pencil in hand. I say, Coach, I need a quick quote. And that's as far as I got. He looked at me and says, who the hell are you? I'm thinking, how does he not know who I am? I mean, I stand out like a Christmas tree in here. So he must know I'm in here to get the quotes. So I said, Coach, I'm here from the, and that's as far as I got. And he said, get the hell out of my locker room. Except he didn't use the word hell, but I'm not quite right. Sure of the audience that you're reaching. So I'm trying to be a little nice.
Thank you, Harvey, on that. Thank you.
Yeah. So then I realized that he didn't know who I was or what I was doing in there. And I made the mistake of trying to explain myself to him. And if you're around people like that, you know you're not going to get very far.
No.
So I said, Coach, I'm with the LA. And he said, get the hell out of my locker room. So, all right, three strikes and you're out. So I walk out and I see Jim Brock, who was the PR guy for the USA basketball team, who was supposed to tell Coach Knight what I was doing in there. And everyone called him Hoss because that's what he called everybody. So I go over to him and I say, Jim, what the heck happened? He turned to me and said, Hoss, sorry about that. I forgot to tell him. So I kind of figured that out. So anyway, so I walk out of the locker room and have all these media waiting right outside the locker room door, most of whom I knew because of my time with the Cavaliers, covering the NBA. And they say, what do you got? What do you got? And I says, all right, I got some quotes on Coach Knight on winning the gold medal. He says, okay, what is that? What is that? I says, get the hell out of my locker room before I throw you out. And they went, what? And I told them the story. And they all cracked up. And some of them actually ran that story the next day. And I got into a little bit of trouble with the IOC for telling them that. But I didn't care because I was done and getting ready to go back to Cleveland. The Olympics for me were over. So I really didn't care. But I think it ticked off a lot of other people in the IOC and probably Coach Knight as well. But I went the hard way. After that, dealing with George Steinbrenner, I kind of understood the kind of person you would be working with.
So those that experience led to that time in the Bronx. Were you kind of like the press conference person for George?
Yeah, I was like the spokesperson, but he really didn't need one because he pretty much knew what he wanted to say and really didn't listen to me. But, I was fired four or five times by George, and after a while you get fired and you realize that he really doesn't mean it. It just means you have the night off. But it took me a while to figure that out. And I remember I was working for the Yankees only for about a month in 1986. I went down to spring training, and I really didn't know him that well, and he didn't know me that well. I didn't know his idiosyncrasies as well as I thought I did. And there was a writer, Ed Swift from Sports Illustrated, who was down there doing a story on George. So I figured, fine, I'll take him out to dinner the night before. And I did, and when we got back, I got back to my hotel room at around 9:15, 9:20. And this is the day of before cell phones existed. You just had regular phones. And so I got back to my room, and the red light was on in my hotel room. And in those days, when you were working for the Yankees, if that red light was on, it meant one of two things. George was looking for you, or you had an illness in the family. And after a while, you start to root for an illness in the family. But anyway, so I get the message, Mr. Steinbrenner's looking. So I call him, and I thought I had a pretty good excuse. I was kind of whining and dining the person who was going to do a big SI story on him, the next day. And like I did with Coach Knight, I got about two words in before he interrupted me. I said, Harvey, I don't care where you are. From now on, I want to make sure I know how to reach you. So I want you back in your room every night for spring training at 9 o'clock so I can reach you at 9 o'clock or after. I want you back in your room at 9 o'clock every day. I had 5 weeks left of spring training. I said, I can't believe this. I have a 9 o'clock curfew? So the next day was my 33rd birthday, and the New York writers were going to take me out to celebrate my birthday. And again, remember, this is the age before Twitter, and you can kind of be loose because someone wasn't going to put out a tweet about something like they do now. And I said, that'd be great, guys, but can you believe this? George hit me with a 9 o'clock curfew yesterday. I'm able to stay out later. I was able to stay out later 20 years ago when I got bar mitzvah than I can tonight. good line. They all cracked up about it. So anyhow, I get, we go out to dinner, and I get back in my room. And the phone rings at 9:15, and I'm happy. Yeah, I'm here. I know it's George. This is great. He told me to stay in my room, and I'm here, so he'll know that he can trust me to do what he tells me to. Well, I pick up the phone, and I hear this. What the hell are you doing? This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. You're fired. I know I can't have you as my PR guy. 2 months, and I know this is a bad decision already. Go back to Cleveland or wherever the heck you came from. You're done here. And he hung up the phone. I had no idea what he was talking about. None. Right. And again, this is before the internet. So I called my assistant who was back in New York. I said, George just called me. He fired me. He said, what for? He says, you didn't see the papers? I said, no, I'm in Florida. I can't see the New York papers. Oh, well, you screwed up royally. You must have told him that story about when you got hit with that curfew. I said, yeah, why? And back then, the New York writers in spring training would write three stories. They'd write a game story, they'd write a sidebar, which is a feature on somebody, and they'd write a short four-paragraph story called Postcards from Florida, which was just about the color of being down spring training. Maybe some of the players were out playing golf or, doing other things just to make people jealous up in New York that they weren't down in Florida for spring training. Well, the postcard that they wrote about me was about my curfew story. Well, the editors of the Post and the News took that and ran with it. And
they love that stuff, right?
The back page story, the back page headline of the Post was, George to PR guy, go to your room. And the News was, George to Flack, you stay out, be back by 9. That was the back page headline of both papers. So
well, you must have really thought, did you really think you were going to get fired at that point, that it was going to be real?
Well, that's the whole point. So, Yankee PR directors, I was the ninth, and this is George's like sixth year of ownership of the team. So he went through them pretty quickly. We were kind of like all like POW survivors because we all had to put up with him like that. So anyway, I called one of my predecessors, Larry Wall, who I actually roomed with in college. And he said, oh, I said, Larry, George fired me. He said, oh, he was just mad. Don't worry about it. He was just blowing off steam. I said, he fired me. He says, oh, he won't even remember tomorrow. By then, I had already made a 10 o'clock reservation next morning to fly back to New York on Eastern Airlines, which doesn't exist anymore. So then I called Marty Appel, who was also a PR guy from the Yankees before Larry, who I knew well. He said the same thing. George is just mad at you. Don't worry about it. I got fired five times. I mean, don't worry. Just show up the next day. Well, I didn't believe any of it. So I'm in my room the next morning around 9 o'clock getting ready to head to the airport, and my phone rings, and it's Ann Milio, my secretary or administrative assistant, as we'd say now, calling me. She was already down in Fort Lauderdale with me, sharing a trailer as our office space. And she says, Harvey, where are you? George is looking for you. I said, Ann, he fired me yesterday. She said, he won't remember that, but you better get in here pretty quickly because he's mad at you. So I hightailed it to Fort Lauderdale Stadium, got in the office. George sees me coming in and says, Harvey, it's after 9 o'clock. You know we start here at 9 o'clock. The next time you're late, you're fired. I said, yes, sir. Okay, that's fine. I won't make that mistake again. Went to my office and just totally forgot about everything that just happened. And I can tell four or five other stories like that over the next couple of years. It got to a point where, you know, getting fired was a nice thing. You were able to get a night off and have dinner with your girlfriend instead of working a game. All right, I'll tell you a quick Billy Martin tale. This is not the time I got fired by George. And again, I don't want to take it too much of time. So we were playing in Arlington, and Billy was our manager. And Billy's from Dallas, and you know, obviously had some friends there. So anyway, Friday night, we lost a game, a tough game to the Rangers, and Billy was in a pissed-off mood. And when you're the Yankee PR director, your job, along with the traveling secretary's job, is to go with Billy, alternate evenings, going with Billy to whatever bar he's going to, so you can make sure he doesn't get into a fight. You're kind of like his chaperone, and if things get kind of ugly, you kind of just get him out of there and just go back to the hotel. So that was my job that Friday night, and we had a day game the next day, and it was an NBC game of the week, which for some of you older listeners back then, that was a big deal. Again, before ESPN had games on every night.
Graziola and Kubek, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's part of it. Yep. I'm glad you said that because they'll play an integral role in the rest of the story.
Oh boy!
So I'm sitting in the clubhouse and I'm looking at it. God, I don't really want to have to deal with this because I got to get up at 4 a.m. to do my game notes. And Mickey Mantle was with us, and I was friendly with Mickey. He was our broadcaster at the time, and he would actually sit in my office at Yankee Stadium in between stints when he was on the air, since it was the only door that opened up to the press box. So he'd sit in the office. He'd come in early. He'd give me a flask. He'd say, Harvey, just put this in your desk drawer. He'd come in early, do the first three innings, then would come back into my office and just relax in there with his girlfriend, Greer Jones, he'd go back and finish the last three innings. So I would come in after the game was over, and I'd look at the flask, and sure enough, it was empty. And knowing Mickey as I did, I guarantee you it wasn't Gatorade in there. and that's why the last three innings were always a lot looser than the first three. So we're sitting in so I knew what I was dealing with Mickey. I turned to Mickey, who said, you know, I'm with Billy. We're going to a place I know, and you know, I'll take care of him. I said, Mickey, that's like putting you in charge of the hen house. I mean, you're like the fox here. I mean, you're the last guy that I would trust. Right. I said, no, we'll go to a place I know, so you don't have to worry about him tonight. I said, okay, fine. So I stayed up in the press box with my counterpart from the Rangers, John Blake, and did my press notes and came back to the hotel at around midnight. And there's a fire engine and all kinds of sirens going off. So I walk in the lobby and I see all our beat riders. And the first thing they said was, I said, what are you guys doing here? I says, oh, somebody pulled a fire alarm. Well, they all kicked us out in the lobby. But George is looking at you, for you. Billy got into a fight. And they always kidded me about that. There was always a line they would tell me, oh, Billy got into a fight. And I said, yeah, right. He said, no, I'm serious. Billy got into a fight. Bill Madden and Moss Klein telling me that. And they're in the back office. You better go in there. So I went in there, and sure enough, I walk in there, and I walk in, and there's Billy yelling at Mickey like a six-year-old who's cowering in the corner like a kid whose dad is telling him to go to his room without dinner, yelling at him, and Billy's sitting there bleeding from his nose and his ears, and I go in, and George looks at me and says, Harvey, where the hell were you? You were supposed to be with Billy. This is all your fault, except you're fired. You're supposed to take care of stuff like this. Where the heck were you? First time you'd ever get fired for something like that. I thought, you know, we basically, Billy went to a strip joint. So I looked at Mickey. I said, Mickey, what happened? He said, well, you know, Billy was getting harassed by a person there who was getting on his case about losing the game. And Billy gets up and Billy goes to the bathroom. The guy follows him and they get into a fight in the bathroom. I wasn't going in there after him. I didn't know what he was doing in there. So, you know, he got into a fight and George said, Dow, you should have been there. That's your fault. Just go back to New York. You're fired. I had to be the first PR guy ever to get fired because he didn't go to a strip joint. So anyway, the next day, you know, I'm getting ready. I knew he was semi-kidding, but I knew to go to the game the next day. So I knew the next day we were in trouble because now we were getting calls from all these New York papers who wanted to get the first base photo location to come down and shoot the game. And the reason they wanted that was because the Yankee dugout was by third base, and they were able to shoot across the diamond and take all these shots of Billy Martin, you know, looking like crap after he got into a fight in a Yankee uniform. And the game was on NBC. So, you know, George called me and said, look, you better tell those photographers not to take those pictures. And you better tell NBC not to show Billy in the dugout or else you're fired. I had no shot at that. So I go into our production meeting before the game, about an hour and a half before the game. And like you said, it was Joe Garagiola, Vin Scully, and Tony Kubek, who I knew well because we were on pretty much every game. And Tony was a Yankee alumnus. And I told him the story. I said, guys, I know what the answer is going to be, but I got to ask this. Please do me a favor and don't show Billy during the game. And Tony put his arm around me and says, Harvey, you know, I said, if you do, then George is going to fire me. So, you know, please don't do it. Otherwise, George is going to fire me. So Tony comes over, puts his arm around me and says, Harvey, you know, we all like you. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. And here I am getting my hopes up. You know, maybe they're going to do this. And he turns to me and says, look, you're a great guy. So feel free to use any one of the three of us as a reference.
Just what you wanted to hear.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, well, that didn't get very far, but I did get a reprieve because after I told Steinbrenner that, he said, well, you're worthless. I'm going to call Dick Ebersole, who's a producer, the head producer for NBC Sports. And I'm going to get Dick to change this and not show those guys. So about a half hour later, he called me back, and the only time he ever did this, he apologized. He says, well, all right, you're off the hook. I couldn't get Dick to do it either. So that was about as much of an apology I got. Sure enough, what he did do is he kept Billy in the locker, in the clubhouse, and had Chris Chambliss kind of manage the game with Billy kind of giving him instructions where he was off camera. But first time I bet anybody ever got fired because he didn't go to a strip joint. And that's all because of Billy.
Listen, Harvey, let's switch gears just a little bit from baseball.
But by the way, I will say this, and I'll let you switch gears, but when Nick Saban was our coach in the 2 years, the only time I ever was able to make him crack a smile was we were in a car ride for about 40 minutes going somewhere, and I was telling him George Steinbrenner stories. It was the only time he ever got to, I ever saw him laugh, and he used to tell people after that, he'd point out my gray hair, and he said, George gave him the gray hair on the left side, and they said, I gave him the gray hair on the right side. So it was the only time I ever was able to kid around with Saban.
That sounds appropriate, that's for sure. How about some favorite moments over time with the Dolphins?
Well, you know, you mentioned some of the people I work with, and I won't take up too much of your time, but I was fortunate. You work with those types of people, including Steinbrenner, by the way, where they're all winners. And if you can't learn from them, you're wasting your time and you're wasting a great opportunity. And one thing I learned from George, and I'll talk about this real quick, is I realized after 4 years, all he cared about was the Yankees, which is one reason they were so successful. He had horses up in his horse farm in Ocala, but he had no other interests. Never took vacation, never played golf, didn't really deal much with his family. That's all he cared about with the Yankees. And after 3.5 years of having that intensity of having to be on 24/7 working for him, I realized that it was really time to look elsewhere because I didn't have that same intensity as much as I loved the job. And the lesson I learned from him is that if you don't love your job and have the same intensity about it as much as your boss does, then it's time to leave. And when I realized I didn't have that same intensity with the Yankees, you know, I knew it was time to leave. And that's something you learned from him. From Coach Shula, who I truly admired. I mean, he was great. What I loved about him, he was fair and consistent. If he got mad at you, and sometimes he would, and, you know, he'd go to mass, but 4 hours later, he's cursing you out like a drunken sailor. But you realize for him, it was over and done. It was like a thunderstorm. So he'd yell at me for something that I screwed up. And then 10 minutes later, as he was running out on the field to start a practice, he'd come up to me, pat me on the back and say, okay, what are the interviews we have to do after this? It was over and done with. But the best thing I learned about Coach Shula is something he called the winning edge. It's on the ring of our 1972 perfect season team. It was his mantra. And I really didn't know what it meant. People said, well, it's just doing the little bit extra that gives you an edge over your opponents. But, you know, you can say it, but you really didn't know what I really didn't know what it meant until early my first year. We were playing a game in Seattle. And back in those days, Coach Shula was one of the last people that actually would have your team. We would come in on Friday night for a West Coast game, but we'd go out to the King Dome or wherever the stadium would be on Saturday to do a walkthrough there. Most teams back then, and certainly now, don't leave until their walkthroughs are done at home on Saturday. But he wanted everyone to feel comfortable going into the locker room on Sunday by going there on Saturday. So we were on our way to the King Dome to do a walkthrough. And just as we got by the King Dome, we hit a train crossing, and the gates went down, and a train started cutting across, a big freight train that cut us off from getting to the stadium for about a couple of minutes. And Coach Shula turns to me and says, what the hell is this? What the hell have you been doing here all week not knowing about this? Because I advanced the game. He says, what the hell? Why didn't you know about this? I couldn't believe it. How the hell am I supposed to know a train was passing through right when we were going to go towards the King Dome? So I'm sitting with our coaches. I turned to our offensive line coach, who knew him for many years. I said, can you believe this? I can't believe Coach Shula was pissed at me for not knowing when the train was crossing. And he said, you know why he's mad at you? I said, no. And he told me, he says, because if he was here doing what you were doing all week, he would have looked into that and found that out and known that train was crossing at that time. You didn't do that, and he felt that you just failed him in your responsibilities. That's when I learned what the winning edge means, finding every little detail, as insignificant as you may think, and making sure that you understood its ramifications. That's why he won so many games.
What about the guy who succeeded him? What was it like working with Jimmy Johnson?
You know, I like Jimmy. He was great to me. But, you know, he had a pretty strong temper, too. And sometimes he would carry a lot longer than Coach Shula. And I learned a valuable lesson from him. Our very first year, we were playing well. And we had a Monday night game against Tennessee. They were 7-1. We were 7-1. And that was when Monday Night Football was on ABC. It was a big deal. Well, we beat the Titans pretty handily. And then the next 3 days, we had all these national media coming in from, you know, New York Times, you know, ESPN, the NFL Network, everybody coming in to do stories about how great we were. Everyone was walking around the clubhouse, the locker room, I'm sorry. Oh, you guys are now favorites for the Super Bowl. You're 8-1. You got the best record in the league. You guys are great. What a great win that was, et cetera, et cetera. And on Friday, Jimmy calls me on and says, you know, I didn't like that at all. All these guys were doing was patting everybody on their back like they won something. All they did was win their eighth game. We haven't won anything. And I can tell he was pissed. So anyway, we go up to Buffalo, and the Bills just kicked our ass. And the Bills' locker room is one of the smallest in the league. There's absolutely no place to hide in there. Rich Stadium back then, it's an old stadium, but, you know, it still is to some extent. So he is furious. He comes in the locker room, and he starts yelling at his team, you guys, all you friggin' guys did was believe your clippings, and all you did was pat yourselves on the back. I didn't hear you say a damn thing about playing the Bills. And then he looked at me. I had nowhere to hide. And he says, Harvey, this is all your goddamn fault. You built these guys up like they were Super Bowl champions all week. I can't believe all you did was look in the past and talk about what we had done 5 days ago and not one thing about what we needed to do 2 days from now. He says, from now on, this week we play the Patriots. I don't want to hear a damn thing in your locker room other than Patriot questions. And I don't want to hear a damn thing from the team other than Patriot answers. I actually thought he was going to fire me. And if he did, it would have been for real. Yeah. So all week, I'm in the locker room and making sure that when reporters ask questions, if it wasn't about the Patriots, I would interrupt and say, sorry, guys, we can only talk about the Patriots this week. That's it. We can't talk about anything else. And the players are kind of laughing. Olivier Vernon, who was one of our defensive ends, when I did that, said, no, I want to talk about last week's game against Tennessee. I said, Olivier, you're going to get me fired if you do that. So anyway, I did it. The players were fine with it. The media got pissed off, but, you know, I was kind of interrupting their question. So anyway, we go up to New England. We beat the Patriots, and I'm jogging off the field with Jimmy. I said, Jimmy, you blame me for last week's loss, correct? He said, yeah, I did. I says, well, you know, I did what you asked me to do for this week's game, so I think now I deserve a game ball for this game. He looked at me and says, you're not getting a game ball, but at least I'm not firing you. And I learned the lesson from Jimmy, and is don't read your clippings, and don't get caught up on what you accomplished, especially in something as competitive as the NFL. You know, no matter what you did, you need to look forward, not look behind you, because if you look behind you and eat the cheese, it's a recipe for losing. And that's one thing I learned from him, a hard way, but it's a lesson I learned from him. And that's why he was so successful. He knew exactly what his team needed to do to get ready for a game. And he saw on Friday that we weren't doing it, and he was right.
Hey, we're inside 2 minutes with Harvey Green. And I've got one question. I know Bob has a final question. But Harvey, you talked a lot about coaches. Was there a particular player, be it baseball, basketball, or with the Dolphins, who was really a PR dream, somebody who just was so easy to work with and made your job and really represented the team so well? One or two guys who really stood out?
Yeah, with the Dolphins, you know, I worked with people like Zach Thomas and Jason Taylor, but, you know, obviously Dan Marino for me, you know, we were good friends, was great. He understood his role as a leader. He understood what he needed to do with the media. And in all the years I was with him, he never ducked out of an interview request. He always was a stand-up guy. He took the blame for other people's faults. If somebody dropped the ball, he said it was a bad pass. So, you know, Danny really understood it and was great to work with. With the Yankees, though, you know, I had a great group there, too, with Ricky Henderson, Don Mattingly, Ron Guidry, Tommy John. But the best one of all was Dave Winfield, and I'll tell you why. He was like Danny in the respect that I just mentioned, but he took it not an extra mile, but an extra 10 miles. Steinbrenner hated him, and he used to rip him all the time. If we had more time, I'd tell you about a story where George asked me to put out a release ripping something that Winfield was doing from a batting average standpoint. And every time George would fire at Winnie, I'd go down in the locker room and say, hey, Winnie, George said this and this. I know you're going to get asked about it. Or he had me do this to kind of make you look bad. I know you're going to get asked about it. And every single time, Dave never took the bait. He would say, you know what? He's the owner of the team. He has the right to say what he wants. We just need to play better. I need to play better. He could have taken him on and gotten a tit for tat, and it would have been World War III. But he was great.
But why does Steinbrenner hate Winfield?
Well, it had to do with his foundation and a couple of other things. You know, just like he didn't like Reggie Jackson. Once George gives you a lot of money, he expects, you know, you to be a superstar every single at-bat, like he did with Reggie. And with Dave, you know, Dave was a damn good player. He made the Hall of Fame, but, you know, but he wasn't going to hit a home run in every at-bat. George didn't like the fact he was paying him all this money. And in his mind, but nobody else's, he wasn't getting the return on investment. But Dave never once, as classy as he was, ever fired back. He saved me a tremendous amount of aggravation. But he also understood, you know, his role with the team wasn't to create any distractions either. He really got it. And like Dan, he was upfront and great with everything. But unlike Dan, he had to deal with Milner, who was constantly putting him down and never took the bait.
Well, Harvey Green, what a treat it's been to have you on with us on Musings on Sports. Final question, if I may. What would you tell a young person today who is interested in pursuing the kind of work that you've been so successful in?
And you guys would know it because you're in the business. You've got to love it. I mean, mm-hmm. The demands on your time and on your energy and on your ego and on your whether you're thick-skinned or not. You know, you've got to love what you do. And you know this because you both have been through it. You know, when spring training would start in baseball, I wouldn't get a day off for 7 months. With George, you had to go to every game, home and road. Most teams, they would alternate road trips with your assistant. But I had to go to every one. So 7 months, you wouldn't have a day off. In the NFL, 7 months, no day off, because the only player day off on Tuesday was the day you still had to do all your credentials and write your game release and all the nitty-gritty things that, Kelly, you certainly know, you know, what that's involved with.
Absolutely.
So, you know, this is advice really for anybody in any field, but there are a lot of sacrifices you have to make, you know, family, personal life, golf games, travel, whatever it is, for the demands of working in sports. So you truly, truly have to love it. If you do, it's the greatest thing in the world. I don't think I've worked a day in my life in the 40 years you mentioned. But if you don't have that fire and don't have that love for what you're doing and the people you're doing it with, where it's players, coaches, owners, media, my best friends are people in the sports field, especially in the media, then it's not for you. But if you do have that joy and desire and willingness to work those crazy hours, you'll have a great career and you'll never regret a second.
Well, Harvey, on behalf of our many listeners of Musings on Sports, we thank you for coming on the show. What a treat. I could let you go for another 2 hours if time permits, but thanks again. You were special.
Well, it was great talking to you guys, and I appreciate that. I've been very lucky with my career, and I'm happy to share some of the things along the way with people who care to listen. So thanks for having me on.
Today, there are smarter phones, smarter cars, smarter everything. So Bridgestone Golf's engineers thought, why not a smarter golf ball? Introducing the new Tour B, with a smart reactive IQ cover that delivers more power off your driver, more control off your wedges. Try Bridgestone's new Tour B with reactive IQ cover, the smarter tour ball.
Bob, great to hear the stories from Harvey Green. A terrific guy, very professional in his approach, very much respected and admired throughout the league. What a great storyteller, Bob.
Yeah, he really was. Yeah, you can tell in the inflections, just in his voice, that the stories are not only good, but he enjoys telling them, and he has a magical way of getting that word into your head. That makes it even sound better. I really enjoyed Harvey Green. Got to give him a big shout out for certainly a job well done on Musings.
Yeah, it was great to have him. And we thank Harvey for his time. Bob, as always, great being with you on Musings on Sports. The United States, again, huge win today. And on to the round of 16 at the World Cup. Thanks for listening to Musings on Sports. Kelly Elbin signing off for Bob Bupka.